ladies and gentlemen from around the Delaware Valley, welcome to the Pain and Wellness Hour with Sonny Banks. We're sponsored by Tony Shuler and Pinnacle Medical Plus. We've got a fantastic show. I'm your co-host, Joe Dougherty. How are you, Sonny?
I'm doing great, Joe. How about yourself?
I'm doing fantastic. Certainly, when this airs, we're going to have a Super Bowl champion. I'm going to lay it out there on the line and say that Cincinnati wins 30-27.
Wow.
Nice.
Okay, pretty bold prediction.
It is a bold prediction. I'm probably so off it's not even funny. And that's how people will realize that this was pre-recorded.
Yeah, keep it friendly. Don't put any money on it.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm not. It's funny, you mentioned the money.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how, and I've never said this on air, but it irks me to see all these really, really, really successful former players advocating and pushing gambling. Is that weird? I mean, to me,
yeah,
it's just odd to see Drew Brees, who I love. You know, he's worth, sure. But I went to Wikipedia. He's worth 120 mil.
Wow.
Why not throw in, you know, another 10 mil, you know, and ruin your reputation? Not that I guess they're doing it anyway, but I'm just saying.
I guess the money is just too big to turn down.
Yeah, well, here at the Pain and Wellness Hour, we're waiting for your call.
Yes.
Until then, I guess Drew will handle the message. Sonny, we got a great guest today. You will introduce our guest.
Attorney Carl Fredericks is back with us. Carl previously appeared on the show in August of 2020 and again in May of 2021. Since then, Carl changed firms. I'm going to let him tell us where he is now, what prompted the move, and what the focus of his law practice is at this time. Carl?
Thank you, Sonny. So I'm currently with the Dansky Katz Ringgold firm. We have offices in Marlton, New Jersey, South Jersey, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. You know, to use the sports analogy, once in a while as lawyers, we test the free agent waters. And I had an opportunity to speak with some folks about, you know, like-minded things such as the nursing home neglect that I have a passion for, and found my way with these guys, and I'm very excited to join them. They have a lot of great ideas about how to take the law practice, you know, into the next immediate future with this new normal that we have with, you know, our environment and also just, you know, the culture of everyone wanting to find their way here, you know, in consideration of all the challenges that we have.
Yeah, it definitely, with nursing home neglect, it's a challenged population as it is.
Sure.
And now with the pandemic, and particularly obviously the first part of the pandemic where it was quarantine, like there, you know, but you know, even now, you know, it's a very, very, you know, in need population. What has been your experience so far? Because it seems to me like now more than ever, obviously, legal expertise in that particular area is needed.
Definitely.
Yeah. So, you know, the early part of the COVID hit everybody, obviously, by surprise. And nowhere was that more apparent than in the nursing home industry. There had been some early warnings, and of course, there's always been the undercurrent of the fact that you have these vulnerable elderly folks who are in an environment where they are subject to disease and infection. And once COVID hit, that really just hit like a ton of bricks. And unfortunately, we saw a lot of deaths in these nursing homes. I contend that many, if not most of them, could have been avoided even in the presence of COVID, but that there were missteps along the way. There was, you know, certain acquiescence by our government to allow immunity to exist in the context of nursing home neglect. And the numbers were just terrible when we see how many people passed away in nursing homes.
Yeah, no question about it. Is it an area right now where things are lightening up? In other words, can lawyers and family members typically get in to see their loved ones at this point?
Yes. You know, Omicron, it was a bit of a step backwards, but now that we're beginning to come out of the Omicron variant, we're seeing that the skilled nursing facilities, whether it's assisted living or a nursing home, are allowing visitors back in again. And that's so important, as you might imagine, to be able to have the oversight of loved ones.
Sure.
For these facilities, as opposed to just simply relying upon the medical professionals, policing themselves, or the state to come in and do investigations, which obviously were also limited by COVID.
I would imagine that staffing is still a major issue at nursing homes.
It sure is. You know, it's always been an issue. A lot of times in the past, it's been driven by corporate greed. There's been understaffing. Now, of course, we have challenges where there's just, you know, service deficits everywhere. Mm-hmm. And nowhere is that more apparent than in nursing. Well, I guess in the service industry, they would contend that it's more apparent. But, you know, nursing homes rely upon CNAs, certified nursing assistants, who are the hands-on for these patients, for these residents. And there's been definitely a diminution of staffing because of that.
You know, it's a very sensitive area in regards to nursing home neglect because, you know, people, you know, they have it's their elderly relatives. And a lot of times people, when they're thinking about a nursing home for their loved one, money, it comes down to money, and they do the best that they possibly can. Mm-hmm. And of course, sometimes, there's issues like dementia and other areas. So it can be very difficult to kind of gauge a situation. What are kind of the telltale signs of nursing home neglect for somebody to look for and, you know, for their loved one?
Yeah. So you want to, as a, you know, someone that's scrutinizing the care that's being rendered by a nursing home, you want to take a look at what type of nutrition is being supplied. You know, oftentimes in these facilities, that's a really overlooked area because most of the time when you go to visit someone, you're not sitting with them and eating with them in the cafeteria. You're seeing them, you know, in their private room. And maybe you bring them food on any given day when you come, but you're not seeing when they wake up in the morning, what type of, you know, breakfast are they having? Is there oversight to make sure that they're eating and monitoring their intake of nutrition on a daily basis? So that becomes very important, diet, because if you're not eating right, then, you know, your body's going to break down. The other thing is, a lot of times you're in a skilled nursing facility because you lack the ability to ambulate independently, and so you find yourself in a wheelchair or even bedbound. And in that circumstance, there needs to be proper turning and repositioning. Get folks out of their wheelchair for a certain amount of time a day. Turn and reposition them in bed every 2 hours. I mean, that's in the federal guidelines. And they're supposed to track from shift to shift that there is staff that's doing that. And I can't tell you.
And all that gets documented, Carl?
It should be documented. And I can't tell you how many times we end up getting a chart with someone who's developed a horrific bed sore because they haven't been turned in repositions.
I mean, to me, you think about, you hear the horror stories. Why is it such an epidemic? I can't remember the last time I was, at a nursing home, I guess since my grandmother passed away, and so I'm not an expert, obviously, in it, mm-hmm. but it doesn't take a rocket science to figure out that it's an epidemic going on out there. What is the number one cause of those type of situations? I mean, you could...
I'm not an expert either, but I'm going to give a theory. Out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah.
You mean
yeah.
understaffing, you think?
Well, I mean, you know, these are elderly people. You know, generally they're sick or they're infirmed, and their family really can't take care of them. So they're just not there enough, you know, to see what's going on.
So they're a vulnerable population. But these lawsuits, by the way, are not new. That's what I mean, Sonny. In other mm-hmm. words, don't take a rocket science to figure out that it's a vulnerable population.
Right.
They're constantly getting sued for negligence and abuse. So we all know that. What's the reason why they continually, continue this cycle, so many of them?
I'm going to go back to a phrase I used before, corporate greed. So we have facilities that are owned by multiple facilities owned by the same entities, and they've learned how to game the system, how to get the money from Medicare and Medicaid, and provide the minimum amount of care necessary in order to comply with those regulations, while at the same time falling woefully inadequate of individual care for the residents. The other thing that's striking to me and really needs to be focused on is the lack of any mandatory insurance for these facilities. So if there was a mandatory minimum that each facility had to have liability insurance for its residents, then you would have the additional component of the insurance companies who would be overseeing things and making sure that these homes were functioning properly.
I'm shocked to hear that there isn't.
There isn't, believe it or not, there is not. And there was a push to have mandatory liability in New Jersey a few years ago because, you know, we had friendly governors who were empathetic to that. And unfortunately, there's a strong lobby that, you know, fought against it from the nursing home industry.
So the patient should have additional insurance.
What I was saying, so if you make the facility have to have liability insurance for their errors and omissions, then, that's going to provide the insurance companies an incentive to both write that insurance and also to monitor the claims.
So in a sense, it's almost like a bar with liquor liability insurance. You get sued enough, your rates go so high, you keep your business in order.
That's exactly right. For sure.
That's ironic and absolutely incredible that an industry that's so vulnerable doesn't have to have that insurance. It's
but crazy. On the flip side, Joe, what you said about the actual residents having additional insurance, you know, that is a way to kind of safeguard against neglect as well, because if you have enough to pay a nursing home, then you can find a quality nursing home that's going to provide commensurate care for the amount of insurance that you have for your long-term care. A lot of people overlook, you know, when they're doing their portfolios and their retirement plan, they don't really plan for long-term care insurance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's something that if you have it, it's going to serve you well down the line, because if you're leaving your care to, you know, you go to a nursing home hat in hand and say, well, all I can do is pay Medicare or Medicaid rate, you're really putting yourself at risk.
I talked to somebody who worked at a nursing home facility, and I asked that a question, how can you tell? You know, how can you tell when you're kind of like searching for facilities? How do you pick the right one? What is your advice in that particular area?
I would say pay no attention to, you know, the shiny foyer, because a lot of these homes spend a lot of money on, you know, the glitz and glamour when you first walk in, that wow factor.
Sure.
There's a baby grand piano in the foyer, and they're pumping in, you know, this great smelling fragrance and fresh flowers and everything else. Then you get down the hallway to the actual living units, and you begin to smell, you know, the smell of urine or just the smell of just something's foul.
Yeah.
And that's when you know that, you know, A plus B doesn't equal C.
Well, it's interesting because that is exactly what this individual said, the smell test.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But your point of you got to dig a little deeper than just going in the front door.
Exactly.
Can be a telltale sign that, you know, there's obviously issues.
What about nursing homes with religious affiliation? Are they typically better than
others?
They're
typically better, yeah. There's the Masons have homes throughout the area. And then, of course, there's, the Catholic diocese.
Mm-hmm.
And that really used to be an absolute, almost a guarantee that you'd have better care. Unfortunately, even those facilities have had their issues over time, which has been surprising to me.
Okay, so I'm a Catholic. So, you threw a softball. First thing I thought of was, well, they're treating their elderly folks better than they are their kids. You know, like I'm talking about in the Catholic,
sure.
You know, the issues they've had,
obviously.
With the priests and all that.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's, and my grandmother was in, I think, Holy Redeemers.
Okay.
And so, you're 100% right there, Carl. They did treat her well. She was a tough cookie. I used to pick her up, and she I used to have be in a cold sweat as I was taking her in the elevator, be in there real quiet, right? So her door was right by the nurse's station, right? And I said, Graham, I said, should we shut the door? Now, she was like 90 at the time, and she says, oh, God, yeah, they'll steal a nickel from a dead man's corpse. They're right there. Right? So we went in, and she had a black eye one time. I didn't even ask.
Oh, boy.
I thought to myself, she probably started it, no doubt. I love my grand, but she was a tough cookie. And then we got in the elevator, and there was two people in there. I was sweating. It was only a 2-4 run, right? But the point is, they treated her great. Mm-hmm. It was a good experience. But the nightmare and the horror stories that are out there, and thank God there's individuals like yourself who are able to keep individuals accountable. When if somebody feels like their relative is, you know, getting abused or neglected,
yes,
okay, what are some of the things they can do?
Well, they do have it, particularly in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, I know, has a program as well. But New Jersey, I really have to give them credit, has a dedicated state office. It's called the State Ombudsman for the Institutionalized Elderly. And when complaints are made to an 800 line, there is an investigation launched on every occasion where, you know, a caseworker goes out and looks at the individual residence chart and sees what matches up against the allegations that are being made either by the resident themselves or usually more likely it's a family member who is complaining. And, you know, that will end up getting the attention of the facility because many times they end up getting a corrective action plan from the state that if you don't correct these things that we found, then you're going to be subject to fines and other penalties.
Is that in New Jersey?
That's in New Jersey. Now, Pennsylvania, they also have individual, you know, caseworkers that go into facilities in response to elder abuse and neglect claims. And it just isn't, it isn't as centrally organized as it is in New Jersey.
Is there a difference in the laws, you know, like in auto,
sure,
in auto accidents or workers' compensation? Are there different laws that favor the owner rather than the obviously the individual in one state, one friendlier to a corporate, yeah, and the other one the plaintiff?
Yeah. So New Jersey, again, I feel like they were really at the forefront of protecting the elderly, even though we still have a lot of elder neglect claims. You know, thank goodness they at least implemented many years ago a nursing home bill of rights. And it specifies, you know, rights that residents have, a right to live, you know, free of any abuse and neglect, a right to not have money stolen from, you know, obvious things, mm-hmm, but they're codified. And as an attorney, we can utilize that as a sword to create a claim of negligence per se if there's been a violation of the New Jersey Resident Rights Act. The best thing that the Bill of Rights includes is a fee-shifting provision that if we successfully prove as an attorney a violation of the New Jersey Resident Rights Act, then we can seek attorney's fees from the facility, from their owners.
Nice.
We don't have that Bill of Rights in Pennsylvania.
You do not. You do not. So it's just standard negligence in the claims.
Right.
And, you know, it's always the scenario where even when the plaintiff prevails, they still have to pay the attorney fee out of the plaintiff's side.
When you do run into a so if somebody suspects something, aside from reporting that, is there any evidence they can collect?
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, this could take time, but you walk in, you see a bed sewer or something.
Right.
You know, what can you do?
Well, they say a picture's worth a thousand words. Mm-hmm. And in this day and age of smartphones, it's so easy to be able to take out your phone from your pocket and document exactly what you're seeing. You know, a lot of people just don't want to upset mom or dad and, you know, say, hey, how you feeling? You know, hey, why don't you...
They have to live there with these people.
Yeah, sure. Let me do a, you know, inspection on you and see if everything's... You know, because you're invading their personal...
Sure.
They're already having their... their personal living arrangements turned upside down, being in a facility like this to begin with. And now you're going to say, hey, while I'm visiting you here, let me, have you pull up your legs and let me see, you know. Right. So, unfortunately, a lot of people don't really do any kind of investigation or any proactive measures unless mom or dad is complaining of pain somewhere. And unfortunately, the bed sores end up, you know, being on the buttocks or on the heels or on the, right, you know, the back where you just don't see them. You're obviously not going to see it on anyone's face or on their arms or anything like that. And so there needs to be some vigilance in terms of, you know, checking in with your loved one and saying, how are you feeling? Do you have any discomfort anywhere? Get them up out of bed. Hey, can I help you to the bathroom? Can I help you, you know, comb your hair and at least get them up and do a visual inspection and see if anything's off or if there's any malodor or smell, because that's a telltale sign of a bed sore as well.
So when that happens...
I was actually going to ask, if you see or suspect something like that, Carl, should you report it to the facility or report it to some oversight group?
Yeah, I
would say both. Because you want to let the facility know that you see what's going on and you're not going to tolerate it. And you also want to now get the state involved, depending on the severity of what you've observed. You know, if it's just something is off or a diaper hasn't been changed or something like that, you know, you're going to appeal to the facility to say, hey, look, we're all in this together. We know that there's staffing issues, you know, but I just found mom and she looked like she hadn't had her diaper changed, you know, in 12 hours. And you work with them. But when it gets to the point where you make multiple complaints and the same thing's happening over and over again, or something really severe is discovered, that's when you need to get the state involved.
You think about the potential, first of all, what's cooperation like? First of all, as individuals, when you have a loved one there, when you see something like that, you're not, somebody might be that calculating, but to me, you see your loved one standing right in front. I'm not sitting here trying to have, worried about a cover-up. I want this changed now.
Right.
They're in pain. But when you think about the actual causes of it, understaffing, lack of qualified help, I've heard and I've talked to individuals who have said, the nurses aren't the ones, you know, they're not the ones actually, you know, doing a lot of the dirty
hands-on,
work, you know, hands-on stuff.
Yeah.
And having qualified, employees, at least enough of them, those are areas where, you know, there could be a negligent situation and why it's such an epidemic.
Right. So, look, in a perfect scenario, you would have a hierarchy in the facility for the nurses, obviously, have a lot of responsibilities in terms of distributing medications, in terms of providing actual care, perhaps it's wound care, other type of things. And then you would have the CNAs who would be doing the hands-on work, doing the bathing, doing the turning and repositioning, helping feed the residents.
Are there standards for each one? In other words, how often somebody needs to be turned over per hour?
Every 2 hours. It's in the federal regulations. But what we find is that with, you know, staffing limitations, that the nurses can't just sit back and say, oh, that's not my job, you know.
Right.
And they're really putting too much pressure on the CNAs. There's a tremendous amount of turnovers in all of these facilities. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've taken the deposition of a CNA and then have a case 2 years later, and I'm deposing the same CNA, and she's been to three different facilities since the last time I saw her. And I don't, by and large, we really rarely point the finger at a CNA or any, even the group of CNAs as being the issue. We look at it as, look, the nurses are the ones that went for all the schooling. The nurses are the ones that are getting paid well. You know, these CNAs are getting paid a little above minimum wage. Mm-hmm. The nurses are the ones that are accountable here. And, you know, the director of nursing is the captain of the ship for that. And, you know, that's usually my first deposition.
You get more abuse or neglect?
Definitely more neglect. Fortunately, there's not a lot of abuse out there. I think because there's attorneys who are at the ready to pursue these claims because there's state oversight. But you have neglect, and a lot of times it's simply because they just don't have the ability to get around to every resident, and that's when we go back to this whole corporate greed notion. Corporate greed.
No, I mean it makes sense. You know, we've heard stories. What's it take to actually? Have you ever seen a facility get shut down?
I have seen facilities that I read in the paper, you know, were shut down. I've never personally been responsible for shutting a home down, but I wanted to be.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Do you find that there's a lot of good employees just in bad situations?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I just was very critical of nurses. There's by and large, nurses who dedicate their time and profession to this type of work are wonderful people. It's just really sometimes they're just a victim of circumstance.
You know, when you look at a hospital, a regular hospital, I remember when I had my knee, I had surgery on my knee, I had an infection in my knee. Sonny kicked me in the knee and it just blows. It's a statute
of limitations. I told him to
behave. I was late. So we were at a hospital, a neighborhood hospital, and I went in because I wanted to get something checked out. They kept me. Okay, and they, you know, they literally had me in surgery within, like, they wanted to have me in surgery quickly. I slept overnight the next day, and my wife said no way. And then we called my cousin, who's a nurse practitioner, and the way she judged the place was the fact that it wasn't that they didn't have good doctors or good nurses; they just didn't have enough of them. And so that overnight care and that attention, in some cases, at least at the hospital level, is where, you know, you find out if somebody, you know, if a place is good, a quality place.
Sure.
There are some places, and we've done labor shows on this, where they were short-staffed. They were in labor disputes where individuals, the nurse-to-patient ratios were like 12 to 1. Some nurses were actually... in high risk areas, learning the equipment on the fly.
Jeez.
And but by the way, when you're in an ambulance or your loved one's in there, you never think there's a labor dispute. And again, by the way, a lot of that is corporate greed.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So you're in a situation where hedge funds own a lot of these things, and they're worried about their
reports.
Shareholders, right?
Yeah, quarterly reports.
Exactly. And the point is, do you think in some cases it's set up to be for failure just simply because of when you're dealing with, look at what happened in Hahnemann Hospital. Okay, the owner was a real estate guy.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, that was a pure, I'm shutting you down.
And the recent situation with Tower Health. I mean, I think that they just bought up way too many facilities and, you know, got shorted.
Well, and so you should be there should be requirements and a commitment to the care part of it rather than the corporate greed part.
Right.
If your loyalty is to the, but you never think when your loved one is in an ambulance or, you know, you're taking them to that move for a nursing home, you know, where it's gotten to that point, you know, corporate greed or manpower or a labor dispute, okay, is and
yeah,
so,
but you know, Joe, shame on us. I think that we're at fault. I mean, there's not enough oversight over these facilities, and there really should be.
Well, I agree, but you mentioned that, Carl, that you know, that there's lobbyists also that represent these individuals.
Yeah.
And the corporate greed, I mean, just like in any type of, you know, big far right type situation, they have these lobbyists that are fighting us, you know, hugely. You realize, and I was thinking of, I forget if it was Chester Crozier Hospital or not, but it was a few years back, we were having a conversation on air, and they had what we call in labor scabs coming in. Okay,
right.
You have the regular nurses and all that, and then you have other individuals coming in and taking their spots, and God knows what the qualifications are of them. That's healthcare is hard enough these days.
Exactly.
Do you find, Carl, that change is in the courtroom? now as much as ever, because you guys are in some cases the only reason why somebody would stop the, you know, putting people in abuse situations.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that there needs to be a push for mandatory minimum liability coverage. Okay. That's number one. That's how we level the playing field against the corporate greed. Number two, when we resolve these claims against nursing homes, and most of them do resolve through an alternative dispute resolution process, it's few and far between that the cases end up going to trial because, you know, we have our proofs, and why would they put that in front of a jury?
Sure.
So it gets resolved at either a binding arbitration or a mediation, and those need to be done without confidentiality. That's the problem here. When we have confidentiality, then the public at large is not hearing, because everybody can go on the internet these days if they're doing any kind of due diligence on a facility and type in the facility name, and they should be able to get a treasure trove of information on the facility. But not if there's been confidential settlements. You're not going to see what has happened up till now.
When you do run into a situation, how hard is it to get evidence?
For
the facility to cooperate?
Yeah, well, first of all, we always tell clients to, on their own, get a copy of the chart. The reason we do that is because there's regulations that require the facility to turn over a chart to either the resident or the power of attorney within 72 hours. And for us as attorneys to make that request, it might be a 30-day turnaround. So we want to get information early, and I can't tell you how many times the residents' ability to get their own chart and they obtain the chart matched against the chart that we ultimately get in discovery is different because they're the residents getting the chart in real time. There hasn't been any documentation of turning and repositioning. And then next thing you know, we get a chart that there's a bunch of initials that they return to repositions, and then that builds our case. So
a lot of spoliation in that industry.
Yeah. I mean, I mentioned on one of our previous shows that they would have these chart parties, where they bring in a pizza and maybe some beers and they'd all sit around and fill up the charts,
hasn't been turned over in 2 weeks. Give me a beer.
Right. Jeez. Right. I'm telling you. So
pieces. Give me pepperoni, a slice of pizza. It's crazy.
Yeah, it is. It is crazy. So there certainly is a lot of doctoring of the alteration of the records. And, that's something we most definitely look for.
All right. So listen, we're going to take a little break, pay some bills. We're going to have more from the Pain and Wellness Hour with Sonny Banks after the break.
Suffering a work injury or any type of personal injury can be a painful and traumatic experience. What can make it even more difficult for a patient is trying to navigate and find the quality medical care they need for their particular injury. Healthmark Enterprises is a full-service medical coordination and marketing company started in 1994 by CEO Robin Lewison that takes all the worry and complications out of treatment for a work or personal injury. From coordinating full-service medical treatment with a top medical professionals, providers, and specialists to overseeing patient compliance and providing one-on-one personalized communications with clients. Healthmark Enterprises handles the entire treatment process for injured workers and those suffering personal injuries so they can just concentrate on getting better. Healthmark Enterprises believes that being injured should not limit one's access to great medical care. Now, more than ever, an injured person needs an advocate on their side. Contact Healthmark Enterprises at 215-563 1315. That's 215-563-1315. Healthmark Enterprises. Pinnacle Medical Plus is a full-service urine toxicology and durable medical equipment company serving patients throughout the continental United States. With over 25 years of industry experience, the professionals at Pinnacle Medical Plus provide high-quality services and products combined with excellent service at a reasonable price. On the urine toxicology side, Pinnacle is a trusted partner that provides the most up-to-date therapeutic drug monitoring technology. On the DME side, Pinnacle offers an extensive list of premium premium products along with priority delivery services. At Pinnacle Medical Plus, their number one goal is making sure their customers and patients receive the quality care and services they deserve. Contact Pinnacle Medical Plus for all of your urine toxicology and durable medical equipment needs at 888-396-8644 or online at www.pinnaclemedicalplus.com.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Pain and Wellness Hour on WWDB Talk 860. I'm Joe Dougherty. We're having a fantastic conversation here with Sonny Banks and Carl Fredericks of the Danske, Katz, and Ringgold firm. Carl's a partner there, and we're ecstatic to have him back on the broadcast. He's no stranger to the broadcast, and we're having an awesome conversation about a topic that is, you know, always at the forefront in regards to our loved ones who are facing the task with being put in or having to live in a long-term care facility or a nursing home. And it's a disgraceful situation when there's abuse and neglect. And we thank the Lord, of course, that we have professionals out there to bring those places to justice, and Carl Fredericks is one of those. And so it's a very right now, Carl. COVID's still around. We got the new variant. We got vaccinations. We got still not a joke, man. Talk about what the situations are right now. There was all kinds of quarantines and for months and months and months. Now, though, it's still out there. And what's the situation?
Well, I think that the skilled nursing facilities are definitely on notice as to what they should do at this point. Now, whether they're actually doing it, I'm finding yes and no. There definitely is better infection control procedures than there were when COVID first hit. What I mean by that is, you would have COVID patients or residents next to non-COVID residents, or even if they segregated them by floor, you would have the same caregivers providing care to the COVID residents and then going up and taking care of a non-COVID person. And of course, that helps spread the virus. So there's better infection controls in place that put residents with COVID designated caregivers. There's better PPE than there was initially, or at least better distribution of PPP, better knowledge of what's needed in order to prevent the spread of the infection. In addition to that, there is no more situations where you take someone, from the hospital that still is symptomatic with COVID and put them back into the nursing home.
Right.
They make sure now that there's certain protocols followed. We're following it, as the public at large, in terms of if you are diagnosed with COVID or you're COVID positive, you quarantine for a certain amount of time. So I think we've learned. I think the vaccinations have gone a long way towards curbing, the spread illness and death as well. And we just keep our fingers crossed.
Is there a vaccination mandate for most residents in these facilities?
Not for residents, but for the caregivers.
Caregivers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that was my next question.
Right. So, we have in our country only about 65% of the population that's vaccinated, but these healthcare facilities, hospitals, and many nursing homes are requiring 100% vaccination, or otherwise they can't have them work there because it just creates too much of a risk.
The firm has a commitment to obviously, impacting in a positive sense those that are harmed in that way, and with nursing home neglect and abuse. Talk about that and the fact that you're in a place now where you're a partner. There's a major commitment here. Talk about it and the experience so far.
Yeah, so one of the reasons I joined this firm was because I've always had a passion for doing nursing home neglect work. My father passed away at the young age of 70 from complications of Alzheimer's, and he died in a nursing home. He had a massive stroke while I was away on my honeymoon, and I wasn't even contacted about it. And, you know, I always just felt like, you know, these are folks that need to be properly represented and need to be accounted for. You know, they're in the golden years of their life, so they don't have much more time left. So let's make the remaining time they have on this earth be quality.
Yeah, and you mentioned somebody who has Alzheimer's. My grandmother had it.
Yeah.
And so, it's a very painful.
It's hell on earth.
I mean, it is. Yeah. And it's heartbreaking to think that anybody would go through that.
So I've always done a fair share of nursing home cases. It never was exclusively my practice. And, you know, then I encountered one of my partners, Michael Ringgold, who for the last 20 years has done nothing but nursing home neglect and abuse cases, dedicated his entire practice to that. And, you know, these cases are not, you know, a simple turnover. The charts are voluminous. The amount of time and commitment is endless. The law is ever changing, and you're trying to uncover a lot of times what's being covered up. So, you know, Michael has really carved out a expertise in that, and I'm happy to be able to join him and elevate my game.
Worst case you ever saw?
Worst case I ever saw was a woman who had a fecal impaction the size of a softball that was discovered in the last day of her life. She hadn't been properly monitored for what her diet had been and what her intake and output had been. She was on pain medication because she had a chronic back injury. And here they just allowed her to you know, lay there in pain, and they thought, she's just complaining because it's her back pain. And then finally, you know, one of the CNAs that had last seen her on a Friday came back on a Sunday, and she hadn't been changed, and she hadn't eaten anything. The same food that was there on Friday was still there. And she said, "What the heck is going on?" And she goes, I'm just in a lot of pain. My rear end's in a lot of pain." Turned her over. There was a golf ball sized impaction that was, you know, that an enema couldn't even touch.
What is it? So I'm assuming you depose some of these individuals.
Absolutely.
I wish I could be there when it happens.
Same here.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Having a parent that went through that kind, you know, not that extreme, but still a situation, and knowing what people go through and having, and you're a compassionate person, but also passionate. What is that like? Are you ever able to get the individual who's at fault on that stand and depose them?
Well, it's a whole line of individuals that are responsible, because, you know, you have, that was multiple nurses' shifts where there was total inaction or total.
Do they actually get on the stand, the nurses and the CNA?
Absolutely. No, absolutely. Kidding. We take their depositions and we video their depositions during discovery. And, you know, it really is compelling to have them stutter and stammer and explain why and how this could have happened.
It's hard to believe that there wasn't one compassionate person over those multiple nurses' shifts.
Right. Unfortunately, right. The closest we got was a CNA who, again, left her last shift on Friday and cared about this woman and came in on Sunday and saw the horrific.
I mean, it's actually stunning to hear that. I must feel, at least you want to get some justice for the family. Typically, do you get when you're deposing somebody, are they typically compassionate or ever sorrowful in regards to it, or are you talking to, you know, some individuals that are just so overwhelmed? Do they ever give you the straight skinny?
Yeah, particularly the CNAs, because, you know, the CNAs, this is a job that they're making just above minimum wage. They're doing the best they can. And they just, I've had many CNAs who I've had to track down because they got out of the business. They said, we couldn't handle it anymore. We couldn't handle seeing the amount of, you know, neglect and our pleas to the nurses being ignored that, you know, this person needs more care than they're being given. That's why I said I rarely point the finger at a CNA for doing anything wrong here, because they're just doing the best they can as the laborers, so to speak.
How do you value a case?
We value a case, I mean, obviously when we talk about a normal personal injury case such as a motor vehicle accident, we look at what the permanent injury is and what the person's age is and how many years they're going to have to live with the discomfort that they have from a herniated disc or from, you know, some sort of hip fracture that might occur during a motor vehicle accident. When we're talking about nursing home neglect, if we look at how long are they going to live, they're not going to live long.
Right.
But we really approach it as almost a punitive damage type claim without calling it punitive damages. In other words, you know, we're trying to establish that, hey, what did you do here? You had a vulnerable resident who you left in this condition to waste away, ignored their bed sore to the point where it got to a stage four, which is the most severe type of bed sore. The other worst case that I saw, Joe, was that I only read about it. I didn't personally have this case. Down in Florida, there was a facility where they were so neglectful of their residents. There was a resident who was found with a stage four bed sore that had maggots in it because they were that just left there to their own devices, you know, to whatever may occur.
What type of just a range? I know I'm sure that, but I mean, ballpark. Cases that would be considered a big settlement.
Yeah, so I mean, the settlements range. I mean, we rarely have a case that resolves for less than $250,000 if we have our proofs lined up, and they go into the seven figures because we're talking about egregious conduct here, and that's the crazy thing that and in most cases there is insurance coverage. But sometimes a facility, doesn't have insurance coverage, and you have to ask yourself as the owner of the facility, if you had just put that effort into caring for these residents, you wouldn't have to be writing this huge check right now for one particular resident.
Right.
And that's happened three or four times over the course of my 20 years handling these cases, when an owner actually had to write a check themselves because there was either inadequate insurance coverage or there was no insurance coverage at all, and we had them.
Are these... So, okay, what type of insurance is that? In other words, is that negligence insurance?
Yeah, it's professional liability insurance, either for the facility itself or for the individual nurses.
Yeah, I mean, having said that, some of these places, like you said, they're held by corporations, probably some hedge funds. They must be somewhat high because it's such a high risk situation. Are those insurance rates typically?
Any professional negligence rates are much higher than other type of businesses, but they're also, making a tremendous amount of money. You know how much it costs to put a loved one into a nursing home facility. We've seen the numbers of how much Medicare and Medicaid pays, skilled nursing facilities on a yearly basis, and it's a big money business, and I just feel like many times the residents are just the pawns in all of this, and it's really unfortunate.
Do you ever go to court? Or do the majority of them settle?
Majority of them settle. I have had one nursing home case that did go to trial, and it actually didn't even make it to verdict because we settled during jury deliberations. There are published cases out there that have gone to trial. More and more they are going to trial because the nursing home industry has kind of geared up and gotten excellent attorneys to defend the cases as well.
So, Sonny, obviously as a workers' compensation attorney, we're painting a picture here, but like Carl said, there's a lot of great nurses and nursing assistants and, that get put in bad situations. I'd love to be able to watch you depose a corporate slickster.
Yeah,
you know what
too.
I mean? Like that guy who really doesn't get his hands dirty.
Right.
That would be real. Do you know what you're contributing to? But in your area, Sonny, Carl, you mentioned PPE and individuals. A lot of these individuals are even heroes because they're in harm's way. They're sticking with,
I see the hardworking CNAs and nurses assistants on a daily basis.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. Like, we're painting a picture because it's, we're talking about individuals that have, always the dark side. But there are also individuals that have put themselves in harm's way with COVID.
Right.
And you may represent them. So in your world, representing injured workers, we've had the conversation about individuals who've contracted COVID on the job. they would be considered, if I'm not incorrect, frontline workers.
Oh, sure.
They couldn't get any more
frontline.
Okay. Are cases like that in a work comp situation where there's clearly they work in an environment that's high risk when they contract COVID, are they easy to prove or easier to prove?
COVID comp cases are tough because you have to prove that you actually contracted COVID at work as opposed to somewhere else. I mean, you know, you're around people everywhere, grocery store, you know, shopping center, you know, just in your daily life, you know, traveling to and from work on public transportation. And fortunately, most of the COVID cases, I should say COVID-related workers' compensation cases that I've had have been short-lived. You know, where the person's symptomatic for a period of time, say 4 to 6 weeks, and then they recover and they're able to return to work. I've had one COVID death case, but they're few and far between.
But you're Sonny Banks. Can't you just walk in and say, listen, I'm Sonny Banks, and here's what we want?
Yeah, I wish I could get over the proof problems that easy.
No question. No question about it. You know, I look at, you know, what these cases and you know, they're so emotional, obviously, and they're so serious. You're never, you know, every time the phone rings, it must be, you know, how do you manage your emotions and stay the professional that you are when you're dealing with a family that you're often finding out after the case, after the fact?
Yeah. Well, I think just the sheer amount of time that it takes to work up the case and gather the proofs and so forth, it kind of calibrates your mindset to the initial shock value that you have when you get that call for the first day. The other thing that's frustrating to me is, you know, we get a lot of calls where it's not something that is significant enough for us to spur into action and do what we need to do in order to pursue the case, which requires us to always get an expert. In Pennsylvania, it's a certificate of merit. In New Jersey, we have to obtain an affidavit of merit of someone who basically, you know, certifies that this is a case that has merit. Well, that correlates to money, having to hire an expert like that. So we can't, you know, pursue every case.
What are the vetting factors?
Well, the vetting factors, just the severity. I mean, again, we're going back to if it's a bed sore, you know, they stage bed sores. Stage one is the most mild form of a bed sore. They go all the way up to stage four, or some are unstageable. And we generally would only take a bed sore case that has risen to the level of a stage three or stage four. Now, for it to get to a stage one or two, there's been neglect. And that's something that should be investigated by the state. And we always tell our clients that call us that we're not going to end up taking their case to at least report it to the state ombudsman to hold the, you know, the resident have some degree of rights and dignity to have their claim investigated.
Is there a statute of limitations on these type of cases?
There are. You know, as with any professional negligence case, it's 2 years from the date that you knew or should have known that you have a potential cause of action. So sometimes, you know, you may not know initially what has occurred. Like, it's similar to a medical malpractice case where there might be, you know, some medical error that occurs during a surgery, but you don't discover it until you're wondering why you're not getting better for 6 months, you know, and there's been a retained sponge or something like that. In the nursing home context, you may not know that your loved one had this slowly developing bed sore, and you don't have to pursue the bed sore from the first day that the bed sore was discovered, but rather, you know, once it became a significant issue. So generally, as an attorney, you know, we like to stick to 2 years from when something started brewing. You know, that's a safe measure.
A lot of wrongful death?
Unfortunately, there is. And, you know, the way our wrongful death statutes are written, they don't compensate for the most important part of someone losing a loved one, and that's your grief. It's a very measured damage on both sides of the bridge, New Jersey and Pennsylvania, where, you know, you can get compensated for the wrongful death of a loved one if you can show that you had a pecuniary loss, that you relied on them for comfort, companionship, if not, you know, financial or other counseling or things of that nature. But just the fact that you've lost someone that was, you know, your shining light, that's not enough.
Absolutely. What can people expect, number one, when they contact you at the firm? And is it a contingency fee?
Okay, so I'll answer the second question first. It is like any personal injury case. We work on a contingent fee basis. The system's been set up that way because if folks had to pay by the hour to have an attorney investigate a right. potential claim, it wouldn't make any sense, and it would have a chilling effect on anybody ever pursuing a personal injury remedy. So, yes, we advance all the cost on the case for the things like the experts that I mentioned and every other type of investigation that we have to do, gathering medical records, filing fees, deposition fees, and you know, then we calculate our fee. But again, if there's a recovery, then we take a percentage of that recovery as our fee. We also hope that we're able to prove a violation of the Nursing Home Rights Act, because then we can make the defendants not only pay for the pain suffering of the resident victim, but also our attorney's fees.
I'll tell you what, man, it's an emotional topic.
It is.
Appreciate, you know, everything you do, Carl, and you know, at the end of the day, we always say a change happens in the courtroom. In these cases, and there's so many reasons why it can happen, it just never ceases to amaze me. If you would, contact information at the firm.
Yes, thank you. So you had asked, you know, if you contact the firm, what are you going to get by way of a response? Yes. So I work, you know, weekends. I've fielded calls, you know, a couple weeks ago, 8 o'clock. I was the football games were on the playoff football games, and we got a lead through our website, and it was important enough for me to, you know, go into the home office and speak with the person for 10 minutes.
Well, wait a minute, what game was it? Was it the overtime game? That's dedication,
right? So you know, you're going to get a lawyer on the phone. Even if it's, you know, brief, just to let you know that, you know, we got their inquiry and we are interested. But, you know, otherwise, you're going to get an immediate response, and you're going to get a quick answer as to whether it's something we can help you with. And by the way, if we can't help you with it, you're going to get the number for the state ombudsman. But my contact information is, you know, we'll go through our New Jersey office, the 856 area code 489-1515, and I can always be reached via email, which is Carl, and I spoke Carl with a K, at njlegalhelp.com.
And njlegalhelp.com is the website, right?
That's correct.
Awesome. Sonny Banks, take us home.
Banks Law, 215-561-1000, and our web address is www.bankslaw.com.
All right, I want to thank everybody for tuning into the Pain and Wellness Hour on WWDB, Talk 860 with Sonny Banks. Certainly, we want to thank Tony Schumer, Pinnacle Medical Plus, and, of course, we want to thank Carl Fredericks, who is Sonny's guest, of Dansky Katz Ringgold. And, of course, you're a partner there. Congratulations on the new move and continued success and a great job you do on behalf of all your clients.
Definitely. Thank you very much, Joe and Sonny, and I'll be looking for that Bengal win this Sunday.
So will I. Listen, by the time they're listening to this, they're going to know if we're experts or what. Right. So on behalf of everyone on the panel, I want to thank everybody for tuning in. I'm Joe Dougherty. Thanks for listening.